Hi. So since it's a living room, I brought some books. And I'm just going to pass them around. And I wrote down my text. I hope that's okay. I'm just going to read. No regrets. The moment is alive, breathing, bleeding into other moments. For myself, it starts when performance artist Neo Bustamante and I drive all the way to LA to see the 1994 production, A Decade of Forced Entertainment. As the title tells us, the work was written when the experimental theater group Forced Entertainment from Sheffield, England, hit their 10-year anniversary. The first half is performed at Tim Miller's Santa Monica space, Highways. The second, less formal half, takes place in a bar walking distance from the theater, and only a few lucky members are privy to it. Together, the two halves paint a history of this collective's working process. The first part is scripted, and the second part reveals how they arrive at such scripts through memory-based improvisations, excited guesswork, and the prodding of fellow drunks. So, what does a theater group from England performing in LA have to do with moments of cultural importance in the history of the Bay Area? Well, in a way, this introduction to Force Entertainment made the situation ripe for an event that would happen 3 years later, their last ever performance of their play, Club of No Regrets, which was housed at SoMarts in 1997. Once again, Neo is my date. And once again, we're treated to a theatrical work that doesn't end at the last word of the rehearsed script, but rather opens the door to an unpredictable and ecstatic act two. This second act is an even greater blur than the LA production between the play and its after party. The venue doesn't change this time, nor does the action, really. In the performance, Club of No Regrets, we see actors taken hostage. They are forced to answer questions that are repeated over and over with little variation, and to read pressing telegrams. The text is borrowed largely from bad television dramas and cop shows. And they have to speak these lines with guns held to their heads, stage blood and talcum powder thrown in their faces, and trying all the while to escape from chairs that they're tied to. The visuals are frightening. Perhaps it hits home, the lights, questions, and microphones thrust into the actors' faces, the actors trying desperately to leave this aggressive eye. Only weeks before, the invasive camera flashes had chased Lady Di and her companion, Dodie Fayed, and the driver to death in a tunnel in Paris. You actually fear for the safety of these actors, while cliché lines suddenly take on real urgency. But at the same time, it looks like fun. This invitation to chaos. What will happen if the actor doesn't wrangle free in time? Will his or her colleague be forced by actor's ethics to pull the trigger? It's a game of chance that the voyeurs want in on. So once the formal actor-audience relationship is brought to a close, the fourth wall is stormed. Some of us take turns being tied to the chair. Others help in a total anarchistic striking of the set. It's the last night of the last run of this production, and while no official word has been given, somehow we know it's okay to not only destroy the set and props, but to set them on fire in a lot just outside the theater, the side entrance. Playwright E. Hunton Spreen wrote about this evening. She said, "There was a giddy tribal aspect that took hold that night, and things went up in flames, an apocalyptic weenie roast that seems unlikely to happen now. Everything and everyone are so buttoned up and held tight these days. It's all about business and marketing and so little about the enjoyment of each other's company." Tim Etchells, the director of Forced Entertainment, opens his book, Certain Fragments, which is going around the room, describing that night. "We had always known that people in the audience felt drawn to get up and join in this very physical and dangerous bit. You could see it in the twitches and energy of people in their seats. So it was refreshing to see it finally happen, I mean, I don't want to get too romantic about people going mad and smashing furniture to pieces of incredibly loud music. But that night, there was definitely a line crossed. I remember that once he had escaped, Will was swinging his chair repeatedly onto the floor and smashing it, and shards of wood and metal were splintering everywhere, and people really near him were just staring and clapping and laughing. There was a weird and inexplicable feeling that everyone in the room that night was indestructible. Perhaps that was the kind of performance we really dreamed of, something beyond. This is exactly how Neo and I felt, like the play had cracked open and we were under its protection. The flames of the bonfire reached up to a height that was easily visible to cars on the freeway overpass, yet none of us stopped to worry that the fire department might be called. If they had been, they would have been incorporated into the magic shield of no regrets. The stage had done what it is meant to do, spill forth and join hands with life. Life glowed with theater. Even on the near dawn walk home, the night sparkled like the world inside a snow globe, the flakes of snow replaced with the ash of that backstage fire. Fires are often central to rituals, and for me that night was a ritual paying homage to the fact that no artwork can be caged. The start and end dates are formal courtesies for paperwork and announcement cards, but the shelf life of any artwork is only as limited as its impact. When I got home that night, instead of sleeping, I wrote my first and only fan letter. It was 24 pages long and was the closest I ever came to inscribing a manifesto. I've since seen Force Entertainment in cities across the globe and have befriended many of its members. I don't know for sure what impact that night had on others there, but I know it did have one. Tim tells me that of the hundreds of productions Forced Entertainment has done, this is one of the few where he can summon up the names of people who were there, largely because they've stayed in touch to some degree. A lot of conversations have stemmed from that evening. He mentions some of them: Tim and Suri, Doug, Mike Dingle, Will, Megan, LV, Gillian, Neo, and myself. Peter Petralia, who saw the work, stayed in touch with Tim and later went to the UK to observe rehearsals. The two met up a few times in New York and elsewhere. In the end, he moved to the UK and is making work there, very much on his own track, but there was something of a spark from that encounter on the evening in 97. I'd like to close with one of the telegrams from the play. Dear no one, I have walked into that bit of park where the tape says, "Police line, do not cross," and I have crossed it. Stop. Do not try to find me. Stop. Because I'm kind of a homemade bomb, destined to explode pretty soon. Stop. Better for you if you aren't near me then. Better for everyone. Stop. Oh yeah, and I suppose it's no surprise I'm pregnant. Stop. For 3 years, I had no sex with anyone. I tried to forget I even had a thing called sexuality. And then one little fuck, and I'm pregnant. Stop. It's going to be a girl, I'm sure. And she's going to be perfect. And I'm going to call her Grief.